Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to the newest edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Weatherspoon, and...
You are the hope.
Okay, I'll take it, baby. That was Joanna Brooks, and now you all know that it's going to be a great podcast.
We got a heckler.
She's with us. So that it is terrific to have these panelists, and we'll talk about them in a second, but let me just say what I always say, which is we've got a great topic, we've got a great panel, and I really think you're going to be interested in our topic today. What we're going to do is reflect upon Mormon uniqueness, or if you can't say 100% unique, at least Mormon flavors to theology, doctrine, practice, different things about Mormonism that are either endearing to us or at least feel different than mainline Christianity, than maybe other world religions and things like that, the takes and the flavors and the angles that Mormonism takes. And then we're going to talk about whether those have... Some of these have faded from the current emphasis within the church. If that fade and no longer being emphasized was deliberate, was it just sort of the natural course of things happening? And we just want to talk about doctrinal change, practice change, flavor change within Mormonism, and the pros and cons of where we are today versus what theological pieces and practices were maybe emphasized a bit more in the past. So that's the basic discussion, and I'll get a little more specifically about let's do this in the first half, let's do that in the second half. But let's reintroduce Joanna Brooks, or have her do that herself, as our star Mormon Matters panelist. So please, go again. Joanna.
I'm the Phyllis Diller of the Mormon Matters world. It's all good.
Center square.
Yep. I blog for, I run the Ask Mormon Girl column at Feminist Mormon Housewives. And I also blog about two or three times a week on Mormonism, but sometimes just religion and American culture and politics in general at religiondispatches.org. And I'm always happy to be on Mormon Matters.
Well, we love having you, and you do. You've been really active blogging lately, and I know you've been supporting the Saudi women and their driving.
Yeah, you know, there's something just magical about those YouTube videos that these women are making with their phones as they drive around the streets of Jeddah early in the morning. It's really amazing how the web just shrinks time and space. It's wild, so...
Very cool. Yeah. Well, thank you again for joining us. We have two new panelists today, though I think at least Todd Decker especially will be a bit better known to some of the people in this community as a pretty active commentator and as someone who attended the Mormon Stories Conference in Salt Lake City. So, Todd, would you, do the broader background introduction, and then we'll get more specific about different ideas about why you're on this particular subject.
Sure thing, sure thing. So my name's Todd Decker. I live in Mesa, Arizona, and I did meet Dan and Joanna in person up in Salt Lake during the Mormon Stories Conference, so it's great to meet both of you. I recently got married just about a month ago, so I'm enjoying
Mazel Tov.
New stage of life. Thank you, thank you. It's been great. My day job is a chemical engineer. I work with a company that is making fuel from algae. And lots of other products as well. And then when I get home, what I kind of spend my time on is stuff related to religious studies. I'm kind of an amateur in that type of field. And I actually do have a blog. It's not very well known, but just kind of something I write on. It's called Explorations in Faith. And I write on that maybe about once a month. I tend to write a lot, and I get pretty busy with work and also being newly married. But I try to reach that every time I can. And also with my wife, we are in an interfaith group here in the Valley, in Phoenix Valley, called Imagine, kind of in the spirit of the John Lennon song, although not the no religion too part, but about you know, just everybody working together and getting along. And I talked with Dan a little bit about this, but we are doing a project where different leaders in the group are going to do introductions to their religions and actually have them visit the congregation. So Mormonism is up first. So in August, we are going to invite the whole group to come to our ward. And the Thursday before that, Heather and I are going to kind of give a Mormonism 101 class. And part of my inspiration for being on this podcast was I was kind of talking with Dan about this, is I want to maybe not present, you know, all the deep stuff, but give an idea of why I find Mormonism exciting and what animates me in it, so that they can get a more personal view of my religion rather than just the facts, although I'll give those too. And that's what kind of got me started in all this studying. I guess the last thing I'll say is I just find religion and Mormonism in particular very fascinating. So this podcast topic really interested me.
Fantastic. You hit everything I did, because, yeah, really, just your being on this sort of just emerged out of our conversation the last four or 5 weeks since we met, and we're thrilled to have you, and I know you've actually done some pre-thinking on this, so it'll be just great for you to throw anything in that you want to as we go. Scott Heffernan, Seattle, tell us more about yourself.
Okay. Well, I grew up in Salt Lake, actually, lived all my life there, but moved up here about 5 years ago with my wife so she could go to grad school. She's a therapist, and been enjoying it here ever since. And I work as a graphic designer and do some photography as well. So I don't have any academic credentials, but I am a master observationalist of Mormon pop culture. That's my wife said that's what you should tell them that you are. So. I enjoy observing Mormonism mostly from a humor perspective, but yeah. So I'm also the co-founder, along with my buddy John Anderton, of the Modern Mormon Men blog. We're fairly new. We're in our infancy, but we've actually gotten a pretty good start. And what that blog is a collection of Mormon men who blog. There's about 20 contributors. And it's a fairly eclectic group, you know, conservative to liberal. There's, you know, bishops, there's atheists, you know, cultural Mormons. So we want to kind of showcase the spectrum that is Mormonism. So that's what we do.
Very, very good. And you and I have become Facebook friends over the last few weeks, and to me it was just you sort of saying, "Hey Dan, love, you know, reaching out to friend me." But we got into We love that,
we love modernmormonmen.com. It's a great blog, but I have to say I'm blushing today because Scott, we should confess, right?
That's right. Within a bout of awkward timing, I put up a post that was my Mormon crushes, which included four people, two of them female, two of them male. It's not, you know, it's not a romantic crush, but it's a crush on the way you approach Mormonism. So Joanna was included on my list.
She was actually number one on your list. Come on, Scott.
I'm honored.
She was the top on the list.
Top crush.
No, I'm approaching 40. I'll take every crush I can get. So, thank you. But no, but go visit the site. It's so great when Mormon men organize spots for themselves outside, shall we say, uncorrelated spaces. Yes. To, you know, talk about their business. So congratulations and much luck and much, much success and traffic to modernmormonmen.com.
Thanks, Joanna. Thanks for being a good sport about it today.
Oh, yeah. Oh yeah.
Very cool. Yeah, no, I'm excited to have you, Scott. Even our we're barely getting to know each other here. Just some of the ideas that you threw out to me about great topics for the future just made me feel like you would just be perfect for this, and I'm excited to have you.
Great, I'm excited
part
to
of
be
it.
Here. Thanks.
So, all right. I would say the impetus for this podcast came from two different things. The first one is the podcast that Joanna and I were on, I don't know, 5-6 weeks ago, where we talked about, the big Pathos article about Mormons are dangerous and why we're being seen as dangerous by evangelical Christians, and that sort of led into differences between Mormonism and mainstream Christian, mainline Christian groups. And it's basically a feeling of mine of like, you know, yeah, I don't want people to not think Mormons are Christians, but I really couldn't care less, or I can't care that much or get that worked out that Mormonism is not in line with the creeds, you know, or that we don't believe in the Trinity. There are enough things,
right,
enough exciting, rich things in Mormonism, interesting angles in Mormonism, that I've never really worried about that. And so that kind of got me thinking, you know, wouldn't it be fun to say, what are the Mormon weird, unique, fun, strange things that others maybe cringe at, and sort of celebrate those, lift them up, examine them again. So that was one of the things that engagement with Christianity and that whole question. The other one is really what's been happening ever since Mitt Romney and John Huntsman announced their candidacies for presidency. We're beginning to see another cycle of those crazy stories out there that say, that really just say, well, here's the key Mormon doctrines, and it's that God, that Mormons can have their own planets, and here's where the Garden of Eden is, and Jesus and Satan are brothers, and all just these sort of, you know, some central-ish, some more fringe-ish kinds of things, and they're starting to show up again. And so it just kind of gives you another reason to say, you know, what ones are solid, which ones are fringy, you know, it just brought those questions up. And so,
well, all that stuff was in the first discussion on my mission. We got to that.
So yeah, you guys want to go to visit the garden? So, yeah, get baptized. There's a bus that leaves every week, right?
Exactly.
Anyway, so those were the couple of things that sort of launched us. So the way I've primed everybody on the panel for tonight is to simply say, let's spend the first half or however long it takes of this discussion to really talk about some of our favorite things in Mormonism that are unique to it, that aren't worried about whether or not we're marching in step with mainstream mainline Christianity, that we, you know, loved as a child that maybe have fallen by the wayside, or things that we're glad have fallen by the wayside, or just sort of, let's just talk about the flavor of Mormonism and the things that we like that are unique or fun or contribute in some way to being different than other groups. And then the second half we'll take our tack down the, how does change happen? How do things rise and fall? How do certain ideas get emphasized or de-emphasized? Is it deliberate? Is it simply attrition? Is it, you know, the signs of the times and the way society emerges? And so we just want to kind of talk about change within it. And then to me, the pros and cons of where we are today versus where we maybe were as a tradition 30 or 40 years ago before this sort of attempt to become and appear less weird and more mainstream American and things like that. So if that works for everybody, let's just dive in. Who would like to propose an idea or two first off about Mormonism and it that feels kind of unique and fun and something that you value?
Can we talk about the planets? Can we talk about
get that
the
out of the way first?
Let's do it.
I mean, because I blogged this last week about the Fox News. He's not a host. He's sort of a regular commentator in Memphis. 30-year-old guy named Ferguson, who has his own radio show and has since he was a kid. And he did, and maybe you've seen it by now, he did this really pretty quite preposterous Man on the Street segment where he went around Memphis, you know, not a lot of Mormons in Tennessee, by the way, and, you know, sampled random people, which presidential candidate believes that if he's a good guy, he's going to get his own planet, you know, like in the most apey voice.
I hated it. It was gross.
It was awful. And you know what's really nice? There's actually Interfaith Coalition of clergymen who came out with a statement today calling on Fox to apologize, which is really nice. So I'll cover that this week too.
Good for them.
But absolutely good for them. You know, and it reminded me, you know, Richard Bushman had a wonderful conversation with CNN a week or two ago in which he talked about this planets thing. And it comes up again and again and again. If you lived through the Godmakers era in the 1980s, you know, the idea that, you know, that Mormonism has a concept of space, right? That there are planets, was caricatured and lampooned and mocked and made to make us look like aliens in that film, which was an explicitly anti-Mormon film produced by an anti-Mormon evangelical Christianity. And so this notion of Mormons believing that if we're good, to put it in the most base terms, we're going to have our own planets. Richard described it as, you know, a very gross caricature of a much more nuanced belief and you know, something that we joke about amongst ourselves. You know, and so it's something I think we should just kick off with and talk about, you know, the nuanced belief that gives it beauty, but also the fact that, you know, this kind of robust cosmology has been a part of Mormon belief in the past. And I'd love to hear how each of you, everyone on the call, you know, has talked about planets during your lifetime, you know, after we talk about the more nuanced aspects of where this idea comes from.
I'm all for going for a more nuanced version of that, Joanna. So that's terrific. Let's dive into planets and the whole fit with the plan of salvation and things like that. Todd, I know that, you know, part of our exchanges, and I've seen that sort of idea of eternal progression on your list of things. Are you ready to maybe take that first stab at a more full framing, maybe something similar to how you might frame that for your interfaith group?
Sure. Yeah, I haven't really had much I don't think it's come up much in my conversations with people yet, but it probably will. As you know, we were talking about the political situation with two Mormon candidates who are running, and then that some discussion about that. And of course, it was in the Book of Mormon musical, as we all know,
right?
Has where Elder Price really wanted that planet of his. So I'm not really aware of anything in the scriptures or in quotes of church leaders that have said, you know, quote, we are going to have our own planets or anything like that. Perhaps where some of that could come from is in discussion of Kolob in the Book of Abraham. And actually, I did study that when I was on my mission about Kolob and all that, and came to actually read an article in the Ensign that took a much more metaphorical look at Kolob. And
as, what year was that? Do you remember what year that Ensign article was?
Well, I don't know if it was new. I started my mission in 2004, and it
right.
was probably around that time.
That's awesome. Yeah,
but that'd be a good one to find. It was interesting, but rather than just a discussion of planets and stars and things like that we know, you know, isn't really the way the celestial bodies are set up, but it made it as an understanding of Abraham showing the stars of the heavens and what the number of descendants that he would have and kind of the progression and hierarchy of the heavens, describing those different heavenly bodies as comparisons to God and all of the people in that hierarchy. But I also have had conversations with church leaders about this type of thing. I remember on my mission, we actually did have a discussion with my mission president where we didn't say, you know, everyone's going to have their own planet, but that the atonement has kind of a different view of dealing with our progression, not so much as just overcoming sin, but also leading us to become like God.
Right.
And so what that you could extrapolate from that, oh yeah, I'm going to have my own planet or something like that. And, you know, we do talk about that in Mormon culture, even though it may not be a doctrine. But,
and we certainly talk about it far less than we used to.
Yes.
At least
yes.
I'm probably 20 years older than you, Todd, or more. And I know I'm 10 or 12 years older than Joanna. Joanna, did you remember it more when you were a kid?
Oh sure. But even back when I was a kid, it puzzled me. It's like, what the heck am I going to do with my own planet but reproduce this one? Like, this doesn't feel like I'm going to originate anything. I mean, and that's the spirit of eternal progression, right? Is that we become joint heirs with God, with Heavenly Father and Heavenly Mother, and that we participate, you know, it's kind of a bland verb, but that we access the same caliber of being that they enjoy and then are part of creative energies in the universe, if you want to render it in the most, like, you know, in a more less literal way, right? Because it always just puzzled me. Yeah, what I'm gonna, you know, what am I gonna do if I make a, you know, what am I gonna do? Like, blue trees? Like, what? You know, I'm gonna make a world that, you know, abides. We are also a religion. Our theology is strongly, you know, oriented around the idea of eternal laws. I mean, so there are laws that would probably be in place on my own planet if I were to have one. So, and this is when I was 10 or 11, which shows you what a freaky 10 or 11 year old I was. But, you know, at some point you realize this conceit that one will make a planet, have their own planet, like in the way that it's rendered in pop culture, just, you know, it doesn't really match the most elegant aspects of our theology, which are about, you know, which to me, I'll always go to the Doctrine and Covenant sections about light and energy and spirits. So anyway.
Yeah, yeah, and I do want to let's keep aiming towards that more elegant presentation. But I think, Todd, you were on a good thing. You were talking about what parts are in Scripture, where we might get this. Where, I think we interrupted your train of thought, so please go back to your framing.
Oh yeah, well, I did want to bring up that there's kind of the metaphor there. But then there is discussion in the Scriptures of things that kind of lend to a naturalistic view of the world, you know, that all spirit is matter, there is no such thing as immaterial matter, that type of thing. And I should admit that as an engineer, somebody who's really interested in science, that, you know, the idea of design does have a certain appeal, and though I don't necessarily think of that as, oh, I'm going to build a planet,
right,
I do have this this interest in participating simultaneously creatively and scientifically. I just got home from work today. We were designing a huge process, a chemical process, and you know, it may not be everybody's cup of tea, but we're taking all these raw materials and making them into useful products. And I just looked at the whiteboard after we wrote everything up there, and I was saying, you know, this is almost like art, the way we're doing all this. Yeah, it's numbers and equations, but, you know, when we build all this, I'm really going to feel like I've done something very substantial, and, you know, created. And I think that's kind of how I get excited about, not the idea of the planets, but the understanding that, yes, there are natural laws. We have this idea in Mormonism that God uses nature and laws, and that we can progress in our intelligence and understanding of those laws to participate in that creativity.
Right, right. And again, every piece that you've said there, I think, is a piece of a more elegant story. And you're actually, in making that case for it, just feels more natural, and you know, it's a much simpler kind of evolution that you would follow if you just did continue to progress eternally. You actually have hit up on some other fun Mormon doctrines that maybe we will lift up too. But I wanted to
get, I kind of jumped ahead there.
No, that was good. I wanted to get Scott a chance. Is there a piece that you would throw in to somebody to you know, not go strictly from point A to point Z, which we'll call your own planet? How would you frame, yeah, you know, this whole God theosis or God making or potential thing for people? What pieces do you use?
You know, I never, growing up, I never thought of it that I'm going to own my own planet or build my own planet. Although I certainly heard it joked about, I never
That's
took
right.
it seriously.
That's right.
You know, the problem is, if any term you use to describe this doctrine is kind of a loaded term and kind of shows either you're exploiting it or you're trying to nuance it or couch it, you know. So, you know, we use terms like we become like him, like we become like God, or we are joint heirs. You know, people that are trying to be more denigrating are going to say things like you're going to own your own planet, and things like that. So I never put too much stock in it. I just kind of always, you know, understood that more the nuanced version, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. And, you know, it doesn't just apply to the planet. Anytime there's any kind of idiosyncrasy magic underwear, you know, any term that we use is going to kind of show which side we're on, or the level of respect we're trying to show, or things like that. And anything is going to sound weird out of context. And I think that's why we try and say it in a nuanced fashion, so it doesn't sound so weird.
Yeah, I just wanted to, I didn't want to interrupt there, but you brought up the magic underwear idea. You know, who would ever think of saying of a hijab or a turban, you know, it's their magic hat or something like that. That would be awful.
It's so ugly. It's so ugly. And you know, and you do hear, you know, and people will trot out. And it's interesting to me when people who have been affiliated with the church, who have cause for hard feelings with the church, which I take very seriously. There's lots of people who have hard feelings about their upbringing as Mormons. But when they themselves come back and say, oh, I heard that all the time from people, well, there's always someone in the ward who's going to say, you know, the underwear saved me from X, Y, and Z, and that we aren't our best allies. But you're right, Todd. The street level, you know, the street level denigration of garments is awful. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, here's what I'm seeing might happen. We could right immediately say, okay, we all seem to be fairly comfortable with a pretty robust version of eternal progression. And yeah, at the end game, if you really wanted to push your own brain, or if you're like Joanna when you're 11 years old, you do push your own brain to actually getting to the omega point of, you know, a god of your own planet. But we all are, at this point, we're at least saying this is a doctrine of Mormonism that we feel pretty comfortable with and sort of like as a sensibility within our tradition. Would that be an agreement? Okay, so yeah, we like that.
Eternal progression is gorgeous. Yeah. Thumbs up.
Okay. So go ahead.
The idea of building a planet, that sounds like an excellent engineering project. That's like the whole package there. but no, it's definitely, you know, it's not something that I would say is a real fundamental doctrine, the planet idea itself. It's kind of an extension of other things kind of carried ad absurdum.
Okay. So for this first section, which is about unique, interesting, you know, obviously there's sensibilities within Eastern Orthodoxy that talk about theosis and the idea. So we're not so unique here, but that is one of the differences between Mormonism and mainline Christian groups and theology. So let's put that one in the shell. Let's put that one away. I don't want to get to the point where we start talking yet about, well, what happened to this doctrine and the deliberate distancing ourselves from this doctrine that came through President Hinckley and some of his interviews and whatnot. So we'll save all that kind of stuff for later. So we've thrown out, we've started with planets, we've made a nicer, rounder, more stylized or elegant case for it. What's another doctrine that's falling by the wayside, or at least that is unique, that you want to make sure lasts the rest of Mormonism's time?
Let's go, Scott.
Okay. I don't know if this is one that's falling by the wayside, but kind of along the lines of eternal progression, but it's more just the eternal self or eternal agency, and incorporating the premortal existence into that. I just think what a beautiful doctrine that is, that we lived before we were born. We had our agency then, we have our agency now, we're going to have our agency after we die, and kind of this idea of eternal agency mixed into that, I think is beautiful.
Cool. I totally agree with you, Scott. That's terrific, but I think there is a difference between Mormon agency and others. We obviously have the piece about the pre-existence that you mentioned, but there's another piece to agency that, to me, draws a distinct line between the Mormon tradition and other Christian views of agency. Anyone have a thought on that?
This is Dan. This is something I've studied a little bit myself as I've tried to understand Christian theology, especially evangelical Christian theology, and notice some of the differences. But in evangelical theology, there's what they call the order of salvation, or order salutis, where there's this order that God follows, and that we actually aren't the ones who make the choice to do good, but God is the one who calls us. He predestines us first for salvation, calls us, and then after that, then we can continue in our salvation. And I hope I didn't mischaracterize that, but one of the different things in Mormonism is that we actually do have agency of ourselves, and that kind of ties in with the pre-existence as well, is that there's this idea that we have always existed, and that that agency is something that is inherent in us, and God doesn't give it to us. He can't take it away from us. And that has implications for the problems of evil in the world as well, that, you know, why doesn't God do everything in his power to make sure that that evil does not take place? Well, we do have an explanation in that view, that eternal view of man and woman.
Right. Dead on with that. One of the terms that I often will hear is, well, yes, human beings have their agency, but it's because God limits God's self from interfering. In other words, there's a recognition, like a lot of Mormons have, that we need to grow, and you can only grow when you're free and you're not, you know, predestined. And so, of course, your predestination is a piece of some Christian traditions, Todd, but not all. But in the other ones, it's generally, yeah, God truly is omnipotent. He has all power, including the ability to take away our agency. Whereas Mormonism, at least there's major strands within Mormonism, said, no, God doesn't even have that ability to mess with our agency at all. That's just fundamental.
Right.
Would you all agree that that's at least a piece?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I definitely heard that, yeah.
Cool, yeah. So that's wonderful. So I love the agency emphasis, and Mormonism has one of the most robust and rich and fulfilling ones. Okay, so good. Joanna, let me throw to you. What's a favorite of yours?
I'm going to come at you with two or three. I'm just going to shotgun them out there.
Okay.
I think Mormonism has a fantastic and distinctive view of the purposefulness of embodiment. You know, I mean, at least in mainline Protestantism, embodiment is, you know, a fallen state, and a body is something that can only interfere with the spirit's longing to be better. And that's just not how we view bodies. And that's terrific. You know, bodies to us are, you know, matter is capable of becoming light in our tradition. You know, bodies are a crucial part of our experience as spiritual beings, and they are meant to be enjoyed. And that's wonderful. Kind of along the line of that is this sense that I always got growing up, and that I still teach my girls quite a bit whenever I'm with them in the outdoors, is that everything has a spirit. You know, that
right.
That spirits aren't just anthropomorphic. That everything has a spirit pretty much all around you. And that this just conveys a great sense of reverence in our interactions with the material world around us. I mean, there's really fun places you can go that when you think about, like, you know, my dog has a spirit, you know, will my dog's spirit and I hang out? Will it have to stay a dog forever? You know, like things we used to comfort ourselves with as kids when we lost family pets, you know. But it's definitely another beautiful, and I think related to this idea of the purposefulness of embodiment aspect of our tradition.
Yeah, now, to me, you're a little more fringy on this one than the other one, as far as, you know, stolid with the Mormon. I do think Mormons kind of think of your dogs and your cats and sort of animals with consciousness. You might want to grant spirit status. But in some ways, there's also I guess, to me, the safer way to say is something along the lines of there's intelligence.
Yes.
With everything, and we don't necessarily mean self-consciousness, and we don't necessarily mean, thinking intelligence, but there's that beautiful aspect of Mormonism, at least for me it's beautiful, of joy in the measure of their creation, whatever level that is. You know,
right.
If I am a cell within a body, there's a level of enjoyment that I have, even though I'm not self-conscious of being that cell.
Right.
So that's to savor to me. Yeah, when you start getting into, you know,
do pets have spirits?
Yeah, and you know, every mosquito that
Let's
you
just
kill.
Say this. Maybe I'll make it more elegant for myself right now by saying everything has spirit, not necessarily a spirit, but right? There's spirit.
Yeah,
yeah, right?
and there's a nice attachment with the Shinto and sort of animistic traditions and things like that. That everything is, I mean, you know, go to Avatar, for the movie or something. But there, you know, and the Colors of the Wind, whatever that Pocahontas song was.
I mean,
there's a flavor to it that's kind of neat.
Well, Dan, I mean, you're right, though, that this does lead us down the fringy path. But that's part of the fun of Mormonism, too. I mean, just, you know, the things we heard growing up about water. Does water have a spirit, and who controls the water? You know, and the stories that we heard that were probably just like theological fantasies about what were probably just mission rules. Like, yeah, missionaries can't go Satan controls the water, right? Who heard that?
I definitely
heard that.
Yep.
Thank you. Okay. So me teaching my daughters that trees have spirit is of that Mormon universe, right? Although right, I don't right. teach them that Satan controls the water, because I really don't think he does.
There actually was a Mormon Stories podcast discussion thread about that, and somebody found the statement that somebody saw the devil riding upon the water, and Joseph Smith made a offhand comment. So there was at least some historical grounding beyond that.
That would put us sort of in the neighborhood of Bigfoot and Cain. You know, that would sort of, you know.
We've got that too.
Yes, we do. You're right. Cool. All right. So, Joanna, embodiment, the purposefulness of embodiment, that it's not just something to be overcome. It's essential. This a bit about spirit. What else is in your litany?
I'll add a few more, and then I'll be quiet. I think, you know, Mormonism has had, and I'm really interested to hear how others are taking the temperature on this strand of belief. We've had an incredibly literal relationship to the idea of the last days and end time. I was certainly raised with a very robust sense of the signs of the times is happening, unfolding around me. These days I hear that kind of sort of being mapped onto social changes in the world around us, right? Gay marriage, of course, being the sign of the times. But that idea that, you know, again, this very robust theological notion that time would stop at some point, right? That we're encouraged to think in terms of these millennia that we're unfolding and of there being an end to time, which is, you know, there are points of contact with other faith traditions in terms of what we'd call a teleology or an eschatology, a sense of time as having an end point or as being ruptured in the middle. But that sense of the last days is special to Mormonism. And finally, I will say, I love that Mormonism still has accessories. And by this, I mean, we still have, like, we heal with oil. Depending on who you talk to, there may or may not be actual seer stones somewhere in the possession of the church. And these, again, are points in which we have contact to other faith traditions. You know, if you get into really high church strands of Anglicanism, Episcopalianism, the props will come out, right? There will be oil. I think there are Pentecostal and kind of like charismatic Protestant denominations that still do oil. But, you know, even the idea of the Urim and Thummim, you know, the breastplate, every Torah in every Jewish temple that I've seen has a breastplate on the scrolls, like on the outside, sort of like a necklace. If you can imagine the scrolls wearing a necklace, and that's the Urim and Thummim, that breastplate. So anyway, So this is an interesting point of contact. We still have accessories, you know, and for many of us, these accessories are real time, real life, literal objects that are enchanted and powerful. And that's a very distinctive aspect of our faith, especially in comparison with a very washed out, you know, mainline Protestantism.
Very interesting. Wow. I'm excited to think about those.
Is that too fringy, Dan? Did I get too weird?
No. The fact that you value that will make me rethink those things.
You don't like the accessories? Tell me. You don't?
I guess I wouldn't have lifted them up in the early part of a podcast. So let's put it that way. So yeah, I hadn't thought of it. I don't hate it. I don't hate the sensibilities that can sort of give rise to the idea that objects can have special power, significance, you know, whether it's just something you can focus your energy on in a certain way. So I don't have any real problem with the theology or the worldview or the sensibility of the world, you know, that gives rise to that sort of things, but I don't like, I don't want those to be, gee, I'm going to go to bat that we, you know, bring those discussions of those things back into Sunday school. You know, the way I sort of feel like a lot of today's younger folks, I don't even know if they're leaving the church partly because Mormonism has de-emphasized so many of its interesting and unique things, and it makes it so much easier to lose in, you know, converts who are coming in and have never heard of these things. I wouldn't fight for putting the accessories, you know, back in the game.
What about for the last days? Would you fight for reinstituting the sense of terror associated with teaching your 7-year-old about the last days?
No, and I actually have I want to talk about that, especially in the second half, when I do think there has been a deliberate decision Yes. At least that's my sensibility, at least as we approach the year 2000, for yes. general authorities making a strategic move of saying, we got to calm this particular thing down here because we don't want a whole lot of Y2K freaking out and all that kind of stuff. So
see, and that's interesting, Dan, because your reaction reminds me, I'm talking about these things. I mean, the church is a fantastic host for a number of different strands and modes of belief. I mean, from very literal, you could be sitting next to sacrament meeting as someone who has a very literal outtake on a very literal perspective on some of these things. I do not have a very literal perspective, and yet I value them as part of our distinctiveness. So okay. I'm not uncomfortable with them anymore.
Right.
But I think you're right. We are in the middle of a really interesting and not well articulated transition in Mormonism, and the church continues to be a host for both very literal and maybe not so literal strands of belief.
Yes, and I do want to talk about that, and I'm tempted to do it now, but I still think there's so many fun ideas that, I don't know, I definitely want Scott and Todd, and I feel like I'm talking way too much. I try as the host of these things to not talk as much, so I really want to hear Todd and Scott throw out some more right now that we can just sort of remind ourselves and say, oh yeah, I do have affection for that idea, or no, I'm kind of glad that one's going, you know, or whatever reactions would be. So I don't know whose turn it is to start. Let's go, Scott. Scott, do you have a couple more that sort of stand out for you?
Sure. Definitely the one that first comes to mind is Mother in Heaven is a huge one. I just think another beautiful doctrine of the feminine deity and something that's fairly unique to Mormonism, at least within Christianity, I believe.
Right.
Another one I have, which my wife disagrees with, she's not a huge fan of the doctrine of the three kingdoms. I enjoy that doctrine, especially in contrast to the one heaven, one hell. It appeals to kind of my, you know, universalist side. And, you know, Work for the Dead, kind of along those lines, which isn't one of my favorites. There's kind of a smugness to that, but it plays into this kind of universalist approach that...
Yes, I agree.
Yeah. I like that too.
It's a good one. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Another one I have.
Ancestors. Yes. Ancestors. How could I forget ancestors? Good job, Scott.
Yeah. Genealogy. Yeah, it's a great one. One that I like is kind of this idea that we can have an intimate relationship with God. I was talking to one of my friends who belongs to a prayer group, a Christian prayer group. She's the only Mormon. And she was saying that less than she thought that the prayers were less personal than she thought. They were more, oh God, you're so great, you're so almighty, you know, kind of we're in awe of you, rather than this personal, intimate, you're my father, let's reason together, let me tell you what I'm struggling with, kind of thing, which I think is amazing, you know, and that leads into to personal revelation and continuing revelation and things like that. So I'll stop there, but those are some of my favorites.
Cool. And a couple of those I hope let's revisit before we leave this section. So why don't I go ahead and get Todd, if you have any on your list, maybe we'll just throw them all out there and maybe we'll figure out a way to talk about several of them at the same time.
Yeah. Let's revisit a lot of those. So just kind of I was thinking when you and Joanne were talking about some of the ideas you were thinking might be kind of fringy, I just thinking, you know, that's great. You know, in Mormonism, there's this history of thinking outside of the box. And I think Joseph Smith really set an example for that. One of my favorite letters from Joseph Smith was from the Liberty Jail. And in that, that's the quote where he says, "Thy mind, O man, if that will lead a soul to salvation, must search and contemplate the darkest abyss and broad expanse, and mm-hmm. you must commune with God. Just let your mind free, explore." I kind of got that sense from Joanna as well, that you know, you're not afraid to let your mind think about these big thoughts, and that's a big part of Mormonism that I really like. Scott was talking about the intimate relationship that we can have with God, and I think that's an important one. That is, there's a philosophical basis for that in Mormonism as well. Is that we have this understanding of God that's not absolutist, where God is kind of a philosophical abstraction that is just, you know, being in itself, or omniscient, omnipresent, omnipotent. these descriptions that we make that don't even seem like they could really describe a person. Not that that's a bad thing, and I'm not ragging on a kind of pantheistic view. I think that that's good too. But there's this flavor, as you use that word in Mormonism, of this different view of God as a person and as a father and a mother too. That's another thing I'm glad Scott brought up. And I think that this has a very powerful effect on us as we relate to our heavenly parents. That when we kneel down to pray to God, we're not just talking to the universe, but have this understanding of a parent who cares about us. And I think this is something really important that Mormonism has available as well, that's as yet remains untapped, I think. And we've discussed this in other podcasts. But the Heavenly Mother. I think this is one of the most powerful doctrines that the world could benefit from in having a God who has feminine characteristics that we can go to and share our concerns with and receive a revelation from our Heavenly Mother and both of our parents. So that's a big one for me is this personalistic view of God as parents. And then just one more I'll mention for now, and then we can dig in a bit, I guess. It's the universalism that Scott was mentioning. I love that one. I'm actually that's the next post on my blog that I'm writing. So I've it's way too long right now just because I'm writing a ton of stuff. But I love the Mormon concept of salvation. And I think if any of you have the book of Rough Stone Rolling by Richard Bushman, his analysis of that is just excellent. And what I love is how Joseph Smith was very, very excited about the vision, DNC 76, of this expansive view of salvation and also a contraction of hell that it includes very few people. And my own view is that hell really only includes the people who want to be there and just absolutely refuse. And that's a little bit, that's maybe not an official doctrine, but that's kind of my own take on that. But this view that that the atonement of Christ saves almost every person who has ever lived. And what a remarkable view. If we focused on that instead of, you know, the people standing on the street corner saying, "You're all going to hell," and changing the signs that we hold up and say, "You're going to heaven. God loves you."
I like that.
I think that has such a more profound and positive view of religion. And just one more thing I'll say about that. Janna Reese did a review of Rob Bell's book, Love Wins, and related it to Mormonism, which I thought was fantastic. I thought the same thing as I was reading Rob Bell's book. It's like, wow, this sounds like something Joseph Smith would have said. I really love that doctrine.
Excellent, excellent. Let's dive deeper on that one just for a second, because earlier you brought up, Scott, the three kingdoms, and you said your wife doesn't like that. Is she just more in favor of wherever you are is where you are, and you don't want to make a distinction between any three kingdoms, and there would always be progression? Is that the sort of flavor that makes her not want to stay, say, three kingdoms, and she just wants it to be any progression at any time? Because I think that's part of Mormonism too.
Sorry. Yeah, I don't know that she even looks at it that that analytically. I think, you know, she just doesn't take it seriously. At the end of the day, she's just like, eh. That's not how it works, and you know I don't.
So she would believe in more of a heaven or hell, a judgment that would say this is your spot forever.
Pressed her on it, you know I don't necessarily look at it that literally either. And I think there's a lot we don't know, and we kind of think we know. You know, here's how it's going to work, and we really don't know how it's going to work. But
there's a tendency to anthropomorphize, and I've used that word before in this podcast, I'm aware, you know, eternity, you know, and there's a tendency to project our known reality from this lifetime onto the eternities. And it's just, you can't bank on that at all.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
There's a lot of people who think, there's a lot of people who sit in state conference thinking that celestial kingdom means one of those really nice McMansions, just with all white furnishings. right?
Yeah.
That's what I envision. So.
Right. And yet, you know, I'll go to Section 88 and dive into, you know, all the different subtleties. It's very interesting. Well, and then the thought, Todd, at the end, you were talking about only a very few people being in hell, the ones who want to be. The part, one of the neatest parts of Brigham Young's teachings that at least has sort of sat upon my heart is, like, you know, I really like this because it's so fair. And that's his idea that if there is a son of perdition and it's outer darkness, well, guess what darkness is? It's simply the refusal to have, you know, to be attracted to light, to other people, to be in relationship. And it's almost like, for him, it's just like whatever has called you together as an organized spirit with, you know, its own volition and its own cognition and all that stuff, it's refusing to continue to engage as that thing. And your what is it he talks about? Your spirit just goes back to its native intelligence. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. So somehow or other, that just feels fair to me. If I keep choosing against relationship, if I keep choosing against light, I will go into outer darkness, but outer darkness doesn't really mean this place of profound pain and whatnot. I guess there is some scripture that sort of hints at that, but I just sort of like the idea that you just go back into nothingness and the whatever my spirit is would sort of just go away by my own choice. You know?
Dan, there's one of my favorite hymns is Know This, That Every Soul Is Free. What's the last line in it? That God will force no man to heaven. I really like that line.
Yeah. And I do think that's very robust within Mormonism. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One to definitely do. All right. Let's do a few more of these before we can kind of talk a little bit about what happens to these doctrines, why some come and why some go.
We haven't brought up polygamy.
As a... Well, I actually have it in the second half as something that, again, I want to ask that question of...
That's right. I keep going towards the fringe, and you keep reminding me we're here to celebrate the good ones.
Well, that's what I wanted to do at first, because, again, then I want to talk about how things kind of rise and fall. And sort of,
well, let me make a brief case for it. I love what Todd said about, you know, that ours is a tradition that really asks its members who are willing to think big, to really, you know, really engage with notions of matter and spirit, light, time, finitude, infinitude. You know, and what polygamy has been, as, you know, I've personally, you know, it's personally been a difficult point of doctrine, and it's one that still carries a tremendous amount of tension in our communities. But, you know, like everything else in Mormonism, it asks you to think seriously about your attachments. So, you know, even though I'm not a literal believer that in polygamy as, let's say, as a doctrine that will frame the shape of the eternities, let's leave it at that. I do think that all good religious traditions challenge their believers to think and examine their attachments and examine their assumptions. And polygamy does that for us as a people, as painful and distasteful to many members as it is.
And by attachments, you mean relationships with other people?
Mm-hmm.
Or are you just talking about, you know, it really forces you to say what's important in this world and what isn't?
Mm-hmm. The latter. Okay. And just in terms of, you know, considering the sacrifices that some of our ancestors made, and the sacrifices that some of us who are literal believers are willing to make in the eternities. The whole notion of companionate monogamy is the most celebrated, privileged since the 18th century in our culture. And we are asked as Mormons to think differently and to examine ourselves. And I'm not saying I love the doctrine, but it is distinctive. And one of the fruits of living with this doctrine is that it does cause you to think hard. Think really hard about who you are and what matters to you.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking before getting into the podcast that this would probably come up, and because if we're talking about historical ideas that have been in Mormonism over time, that is a, you know, big elephant in the room at times, since that was, you know, to be Mormon in the late 19th century, that's what it meant. I think that was a big part of your identity. And I really like this what I think is a healthy perspective that I'm hearing from Joanna. That, and I, it just made me think that, you know, we shouldn't pretend that it's not there, and that we can be at peace with it. You know, we don't have to accept it. You know, I don't. It's not something that I ever plan on doing or in this life or in the eternities. And I know that everyone in my family feels the same way. But at the same time, you know, I as I read the writings and journals of people from that time period, you know, they weren't bad people. They had these they had an understanding of what they were doing, why they were doing it. And I'm personally at the point where I can say, yeah, you know, that's part of our history, not something perhaps that we emphasize anymore, but you know, it's an interesting thing to look at and to study.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, Joanna, you're definitely you're screwing it all up, but yet on the other hand, you're making subtle points that I think will be important for me to re-listen to several times and you know, kind of let them wash over me a bit without having to totally comment on it right now. But no,
again, let me just tell you, I was 10 years old and I was like, all right, question. The only way for my sister to get to the highest level in heaven is for her to marry my husband. What do you do? You know?
Wow, yeah.
I mean, it puts you in that position. When you're a Mormon woman, you think about these things. And you say, all right, fine, have my husband. Whatever. You know, but I mean, not like that's who I am today. But I think there's something about the rigor and the demanding quality of our theology, that even if it's really uncomfortable for us to talk about polygamy, it is... It continues to be a major part of who we are, even in mainstream Mormonism.
I think also there's room, you know, within our worldview to say either I'm not comfortable with this, I don't think it's going to be practiced in the eternities, or to say, you know, if it is, hopefully by the time I get there, it's been eons or whatever, and I'm, you know, at a place where, okay, I can accept this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
I think we can reconcile it that way.
Oh, and I agree with that. And when I talk about it in the most expansive theological ways, and I try and strip the gender asymmetry out of it, and I link it to this wonderful doctrine I do feel great about lifting up that we only touched on briefly, that, you know, our salvation is bound up with that of our ancestors, right? That we are sort of sealed together in these chains of humanity across time. And, you know, and the core principle in that is that no one enters heaven alone, right? And there's something probably more majestic if there is a kernel of truth in polygamy, if it has been sort of distorted by, let's say, the appetites of human beings or the way that gender is lived on this earth. You know, the idea that we all have to go to heaven together somehow is a beautiful doctrine to me.
Thanks, Joanna. And for our listeners, I realize that there was some static that you're probably going to pick up there, and we're just having a little bit of a connection problem. We've had to stop and start a few times. Joanna's in a new place, and the wireless isn't working great, and so we're kind of losing, and things are fading in and out. But we're determined to keep going. But Joanna, you're basically saying, drop me from this call. I can't stand this any longer. And so we are trying our hardest not to drop Joanna's voice for the rest of this discussion. So, but anyway, we apologize and acknowledge that there may have been some static there, and we hope that we won't encounter that again, but I just wanted to warn you what was happening here. Before we leave some of the other things on the list, I want to go a little bit deeper. I was excited for you, Scott, to bring up the intimate relationship with God, the idea that, you know, God is a being that's approachable with our own problems, our own, you know, concerns, that it's a very personal feeling, God. And I do think that's fun and maybe easier to think that Mormonism has something to say that's unique and different about that, but I have a feeling we might offend a lot of Christians.
Yeah, I was fearing the same thing. I may have come across like, oh, we have this personal relationship with God and they don't, so we are cool and they are not. I did not mean to do that. I do appreciate in Mormonism the personal relationship that we have, and I think other churches have that as well. So. Just one thing I like about Mormonism, but that's probably not unique to Mormonism.
Right. And I mean, I remember talking with people like, oh, you know, if they believe in the Trinity and it's everywhere yet nowhere, and yet probably in their own brains they're thinking of a personal being, So I remember that sort of rhetoric floating around my head, you know, somewhere along the lines. But then I've had my friends who have a very robust understanding, or at least have spent a lot of time imagining what the Trinity is like. And they'll talk about the personal face of that Trinity being Jesus Christ. And so in some ways, as they enter the prayer mode and the prayer relationship, they're thinking more of Jesus. And that is, of course, a very personal being. So
sure. That's a very good point. I know Marcus Borg has made that point many times, that Jesus is one of the ways that we see the human face of God. And the Gospel of John talks a lot about that, too. So it's definitely something that's in a lot of Christianity.
Right.
I'm glad you made that point.
Yeah, but I do think, you know, the fact that hardly any of our prayers are scripted, you know, and things
certainly.
Like that. Certainly kind of really that child-parent relationship, you know, that eventually evolves into that friend of God relationship. You know, I think as Phil McLemore was arguing in his podcast and an article that's coming out in Sunstone that I helped edit and different things like that, there is this advancement from parent-child onto friend of God, you know, and different levels of relationship. But there is that sort of sense within Mormonism of a God that's not very distant from us.
It's God not, likes it's, company.
Yeah, God likes company. God wants relationship.
That's Laurie Winder Stromberg's line, wonderful Mormon feminist. We have a God likes company.
Very, very good.
And perhaps,
go ahead, please.
Sorry,
no, go.
Just one thing I was going to mention there that and you can comment on this, how different it is, but I think one thing that is a little different about Mormonism is the view that God is not so different from us. In that, you know, in the King Fall Discourse, Joseph Smith talks about how God, being an exalted man, very much a little more anthropomorphic. And so that there is that potential that, you know, we can become more like him. That is kind of that ideal that we can strive for.
Yes, and you know, and a piece of that is maybe someplace that I wanted to go that none of you have mentioned so far, and that's the whole idea that God did not create us in the sense of out of nothing, that, you know, we don't believe in the you know, for us, it's matter unorganized that gets called together. Everything's eternal. And so God is in a relationship right from us from the beginning of us having our own intrinsic power and our own, just our own stuff is brought to the table. So God is automatically already in a relationship with us. It's not like God started a relationship with us upon creation. And so the nice thing about that is this lack of radical distance between a creator and this creator's created creatures. We are not creatures. We are children, or at least we grow at some point into children. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. And I think, you know, this kind of touches on another idea of Mormonism that I don't want to veer away from what you're saying, but a general positive view of humanity, that it's not that God's way up here and we're just so low and so much worse,
right,
so
exactly.
Much more evil, that God doesn't view us that way, but that we are good and we have our problems, but God is willing to work with us, and that he wants to be in a very personal relationship with us, that's as equal as you know we're able to make it, that he doesn't want to be our overlord, as you know,
an
oppressive master, anything like that.
Right, or he doesn't want us just to simply worship. God wants us to enjoy whatever status, power, joy, level that God has. There's no jealousy that, you know, if I give to you, that I've lost anything.
Go ahead. Oh, yeah, sorry. Dan, I was just thinking, you know, you brought up the point of that in all these things that we're saying, other people might hear, oh, well, they're saying Christians don't believe these things. And, of course, all my interfaith friends, I don't want them to be coming after me and accusing me of that. But I think, you know, in the point that I was just making about how there's not so much of a distance, I'm not saying that perhaps other Christians don't believe that, but it's a flavor of Mormonism, right? Something that we emphasize, something that perhaps other people wouldn't have thought about that we can offer.
Okay,
is that a positive enough spin on it?
Yeah, and Joanna, you were about to jump in?
Well, no, and just listening to both of you, I mean, it seems that one of the consistent features of our distinctiveness has to do with the way that Mormon theology sort of steps past what's called sometimes in philosophy the Manichaeanism, like this strongly black and white binary view of essential realities, that there is good and evil, Satan and God, matter and spirit. And, you know, in so many ways, our theology pushes us to see all of, you know, all things as sort of inhabiting this continuum of matter and spirit, of light and dark, with, you know, actual processes of spirit that can move us along towards light, towards good. And it just really jars against this older and more traditional Christian sense of Manichaeanism, this radical binary. I think that's why it freaks people out that we say Jesus and Satan are brothers. I never have understood why they're brothers to anybody.
I know. But, it's,
you know, yeah. So, you know, I got freaky relatives. Okay. You know, but, you know. But again, it just jars against the sense that there's only two categories, right? And that they're opposed. I mean, opposition is an important part of Mormon theology, but it's not the same as a Manichaeanism.
Yeah, right. Excellent. And part of the Jesus and Satan as brothers things go come from, there's that class of beings called angels that are so different between Mormon views and the traditional Christian view. And so, you know, the fact with us as Mormons, you know, there is no separate class of angels. All the angelic visitors and whatnot that have ever come to this earth have always been, you know, spirits just like us, instead of this different class of beings that, you know, when you get into God and or Jesus and Satan, it's playing at a different level than what you just sort of said, Joanna.
That's great, Dan. You've just given me a way to be able to answer that question when it comes up.
Yeah.
I can understand.
Yeah, Paradise Lost, Milton's Paradise Lost, I think is really a great place to sort of get a feel for the war in heaven being about angels saying, what are you doing creating this other whole class of beings, and all of a sudden we're supposed to serve them? You know, I mean, that's Satan's big argument to get a third of his buddies to go with him, is like, why did you change this? We're just perfectly happy with God and us, and now he creates these people of clay. We were born of fire. We're angels. Humans are born of clay, and we're supposed to, you know, you've changed the whole order. And so the argument's very robust and very interesting within that, but it all plays at that different level that Mormons have sort of flattened out and said there's no...
Right, you know, coming from different directions.
Yeah. Anyway, so, all right, let's do this, guys, as we want to head into the home stretch and really want to hit on that second half. So first of all, let me say to our listeners, if you've got a favorite Mormon thing, I want you to blog about it, and I want us to have a great discussion. I can see this one generating a ton of really cool discussion about all your favorite things within Mormonism and all the things that you don't like within Mormonism, and maybe Joanna can come along and help us spin it into this. What's the principle behind it? What's the other stuff? So we'll have a good time just talking about Mormon uniqueness, or at least, that's the hard word, but Mormon distinctiveness, or the way we add two or three
weirdness
things together. Yeah, good.
Weird word.
Yeah, in fact, there was a little talk, or I was chatting with somebody else, and they said suggest that we call this "Keeping Mormonism Weird." You know, as the title for this one. So we'll see. Who knows
That's
what I'll
funny.
End up naming it when I
want T-shirts and bumper stickers. I tell you,
keep Mormonism weird. Cool. All right. So now let's just talk a little bit. Let's just assert the following. These things that we've talked about, some of them are certainly still alive and well within Mormonism today. Some have become de-emphasized. Let's talk about the processes that happen within Mormonism, where certain doctrines rise and fall, become prominent, fall out of prominence. I want to talk about some of that being, you know, how much of it is it natural, how much is it deliberate and strategic acting, you know. To me, it brings up a connection with the blacks and the priesthood, where we seem to refuse to want to denounce past racist statements and things and sort of let them just fade away into the past. And is that truly the Mormon way, that doctrines like this rise and fall? So who wants to start? Joanna, just in case we lose you with the crazy internet connection stuff, would you jump in and kind of start this second half of the discussion?
Sure, and everyone, my apologies. I'm going to get this worked out for the next time I come back, if Dan will have me. But, you know, I mean, Dan, you know, and we've caught ourselves at different moments during this conversation having, you know, sort of awkward, you know, around the especially difficult distinctive doctrines, because we do have mixed feelings about some of our own doctrines, and we are at a really interesting time – in the history of the church where there is a strong transition in messaging happening. If you go to the LDS.org websites, you know, what are the things that we see on our homepage that we advertise as, you know, the top notes, if you will, of our messaging? We don't even call it the plan of salvation anymore. It's a plan of happiness. We talk about there's an emerging doctrine of the family, but they're very, you know, they don't celebrate some of these more expansive, cosmological, challenging aspects of our theology. And that's part of it is a factor of our growth as a worldwide church. And it's, you know, correlation 2.0, 3.0, the sense that, you know, unless the messaging meets new members where they live, we're going to lose people. But I think all of us are, you know, have a sense that one of the great strengths of Mormonism is its ability to command such a robust worldview, and that it's commanded such devotion from its followers because they're willing to entertain and grapple with these truly challenging, mind-expanding doctrines, if you will. And yet we've seen our leaders in public try and do this dance. And yes, I think you're right, Dan. The way we've preferred to handle it, at least our leaders have preferred to handle it, is just to de-emphasize, sweep it under the rug. You know, Gordon B. Hinckley will be seen as an absolutely pivotal figure in this, in terms of his training as a PR guy and how he could, with sort of a telegenic wink to the 60 Minutes host, you know, sort of sweep away what some of us thought were, you know, like actual doctrines or controversies, strong feelings. And he modeled a certain light touch feature that I think a lot of Orthodox Mormons in the 21st century like to emulate, but it's not going to save us forever, I'm afraid. You know, a lot of our doctrines are going to come up for greater scrutiny in the coming year with the election, and there's a lot of us who want to hold on to the nuance and complexity because it does deliver a level of richness. So, you know, I see really the church is at a really interesting point. It's having to serve as a host for both people who continue to maintain literal belief as well as those who don't maintain a literal belief in many aspects of doctrine, but still love or have an affection for the doctrine as doctrine, as a system of thought. One problem, and then I'll hand the mic over, that we have is that we don't have a cultivated class of theologians. We are not interested in theologians as a people. You know, the BYU religion department is not a body of theologians who, you know, are charged with setting forth year by year what current doctrine looks like. People play a strongly apologetic function, and then everyone else is kind of very pragmatic, very administrative. So there is no body of scholars to whom we turn at any point in time and say, what exactly do we believe, and how is that exactly compatible with new discoveries about science or, you know, advances in 21st century thought? You know, we don't have that ongoing dialogue happening in public. Unless it's in places like this, which is why you should subscribe. Okay, I'm done.
Exactly. Subscribe to this, but Sunstone Dialogue, certainly conferences, Society for Mormon Philosophy and Theology. These things are wrestled with, but you're right. It isn't reaching the mainstream or the main body of the church. And certainly I don't think the leaders are particularly worried about the doctrine advancing. So Joanie,
yeah, President Hinckley style was a wink and a smile,
right?
And that worked for some things, but for others, it was you know, with all due respect to, you know, to the prophet, it was deeply unsatisfying and even hurtful in some ways. You know, to have, you know, issues personally. For my example, you know, women's issues. Oh, our women are happy. You know, and this is not a doctrinal feature, but you know, that was the way President Hinckley did choose to handle a lot of things. You know, by putting the best foot forward, and there are positive things to say about that, but that's also, it doesn't necessarily convey deep respect for the complexity of the tradition and the experience of the members. So,
right. Todd or Scott, you want to jump in? I still want to steer us some more later, but please jump in with your initial forays.
Yeah, I have just some thoughts on that. I think, you can't talk about this topic without bringing up correlation. Of course, it's really what has driven this whole thing. And, you know, Damon Smith has done some great work on this that I've been studying. But I think kind of you see around 1950s, David O. McKay, a big shift in the way Mormonism was presented to the world. You know, no more beards. It's kind of like a change to the all-American look that, you know, we're not different from you. We're very much the same. This effort to look unthreatening, which, you know, it has its benefits, and I can understand why we've done that. You know, we don't want to scare people right from the front door, but to a certain extent, I don't know if we can really help that. There's already all this information and stereotypes out there, and the problem is we're not really addressing all of it. And you know, I think it's I've heard Elder Ballard, Elder Oak say, you know, we need to frame the discussion. We shouldn't let other people talk for us. But if we're afraid to talk about the issues that our critics are talking about, then we're going to be at a disadvantage. So if people are out there talking about, you know, Jesus and Satan being brothers, or Mormons wanting their own planets and these type of things, if we don't get out there and talk about them in the positive way that we understand it and take ownership of our faith, then other people are going to do it for us, and it's not going to look nearly as pretty.
All right.
Very good.
You make an interesting point about President McKay, Todd, and I think, too, you know, just studying Damon's work on correlation, you know, a lot of how our identities as Mormons have developed over the course of the 20th century was that we withdrew our weirdness into the precincts of our minds, you know, and in our mind, that's something Damon talks about, that, you know, we learn to adapt certain go-along, get-along performance, you know, especially post-manifesto era. That was a pivotal shaping point. Right. And you know, and a lot of these robust, cosmologically thick doctrines were very much alive and well, even as the church was correlating, modernizing, you know, bureaucratizing. They were certainly robustly alive when I was growing up in the 70s in Southern California. Yeah. In the 80s. And so, you know, we lived with that tension. Now, the question is, how long can a body of knowledge be held within the precincts of our minds and alluded to only in jokes and in high priest quorum? Because let me tell you, we're not talking about in Relief Society that much. Mm-hmm. You know, how long can this body of doctrine be held in tension or in suspension and yet continue to be passed on? And Dan, that's something you brought up. Like, are we facing... Yeah. The expiration of an entire body of doctrine, or at least lore, and there's nothing wrong in my universe with lore or legend. It's part of our tradition. But I mean, will the kids know? Will they tell their kids? Will it cease
right.
to
happen? Absolutely.
And
is the version of the plan of happiness and the emphasis on the family enough distinctiveness to really create loyalty and, oh man, there's something really at stake here that I'm a Mormon or I'm not a Mormon. But so I want to ask those questions at the end. I want Scott to have a chance, though, to kind of react on how things get shaped.
Yeah, I guess, you know, Joanna and Todd have said it well. My only thing with how... my only view, I guess, or my only unique view with how doctrine changes and things like that over time, or what's emphasized changes, is just, you just, what people, there's an unwritten rule in the church of watch the brethren. It's a well understood rule, and that's what we should be doing. And so, you know, the brethren choose to emphasize things, they choose to de-emphasize things or ignore things. And we watch the brethren and see what they do. And so if they're not talking about something, we subconsciously notice that. And so when someone does talk about that thing, it's awkward in church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting point.
You know, mentions something, you know, mentions Heavenly Mother or something in a talk, it's a very apparent, you know, it's very... we notice it right away. And you know, some of us love that, but it's also creates kind of an awkwardness, because we know the brethren aren't talking about that. And so people get uncomfortable, and then eventually those things happen less and less, and we just kind of ignore them and we move on, and we're watching the brethren for what is okay to talk about.
Very interesting. Okay, that leads me to ask, so here we are at our current state with, you know, all of us, without having to enumerate it, we can say that we all have probably a pretty good feel of what's in and what's out and what causes these awkward pauses or whatnot. Okay, pros and cons of where we are now. Are we better off, say, now than we were 30 or 40 years ago on a scale? What have been the gains? What have been the losses?
Oh. I like the fact that black people have the priesthood now. Glad to see that bit of folk doctrine. Well, no, not the doctrine evaporate, unfortunately, just the practice.
Right. Cool.
No, it's, I mean, it's hard though. I mean, that, I, you know, that was half in jest. I mean, I really am glad that the priesthood ban was lifted, but I mean, it's hard to take a linear viewpoint at it because I don't think consciousness or religious movements move necessarily in a linear fashion.
Okay. So, okay. Then let's maybe do this. Let's state a pro that many people would consider a pro, and that is Mormonism, at least for many people, obviously some of these polls are showing that it's still not very well thought of, but we have more mainstream acceptance today than we probably have at any time in our history. Would you say that's true? And many of us might say that's a pro. So that's a positive thing that we have now because of President Hinckley's thrust, and we're not weird, and let's de-emphasize the uniqueness and kind of emphasize where we match up. Yeah. So we have that, and so now one of the pros means we've got a couple of serious contenders for the Republican nomination for President of the United States. Okay, so that's a pro, but at what cost to the church, its long-term health, sort of the things Joanna was talking about a minute ago, are we facing because of that?
Well, can I ask a question in regard to that? So you, that definitely is a pro. I like to be more accepted, of course. But is that a consequence of de-emphasizing perhaps the doctrines that we've been talking about? If some of these doctrines had been more emphasized, would that not have happened?
I agree. I want to go there. So do you have a thought on that particular question?
I'm thinking about it. If somebody has something to say on that.
I happen to think that greater acceptance of Mormons has to do with the rising economic class status of Mormons in the U.S. more than anything else. I think internally many of us are just as weird as we've ever been. And if some of our non-Mormon neighbors knew what even high-powered, wealthy Mormons were actually thinking in their heads, their jaws would drop. Their jaws would drop. I mean, for those who are still literal believers, I think our class status has helped us pass. You know.
Wow, fascinating.
Yeah, and I think it's really been interesting, too, I really think you're right, Scott, about the Watch the Brethren. And I think, you know, Gordon B. Hinckley was a PR man. We've been led by a lot of people who are sensitive, who really know how to develop a business plan. But I think the history of the church may teach us that in some phases in our history, a lot of our growth has come from fairly unexpected synchronicities in elements of our doctrine that are distinctive and, you know, we'll just say weird, with peoples we were teaching. I think about the power, for example, of, you know, our view of the relationship between the generations and the role of ancestors and how that's been a very powerful point of appeal to entire, you know, cultures and nations of people who are now a part of the mainstream church, you know. I know,
very
you know,
good.
And, you know, and we weren't able to game that situation. You know, when I see the idea, you know, the plan of happiness, the doctrine of family, yes, it's really important to have a wonderful basic message that really touches people where they live. But there are parts of our expansiveness that are also extremely appealing to people that we can't predict. And it's a shame to see, you know, maybe some of those take a back seat.
Yeah, if I could run off of that a little bit, I guess I'll just take kind of my pet doctrine, of the expansive doctrine of salvation. And I don't know if this is so much de-emphasized, although perhaps we don't take as much advantage of it as we can. But what if we really emphasized and published this view that we believe that, you know, the whole human family, most of us, are going to be quite well off in the eternities. And, you know, would that push people away? Would that make Mormons less accepted? I have a hard time thinking that it would. It perhaps maybe among people who really do have a very strong heaven-hell view that's what they should have and are orthodox in that way. But among the majority of Americans, I think that would be something that would be appealing.
Right, and that's what Rob Bell's book is proving, and that's certainly where some of the changes in Catholic doctrines, you know, haven't sat well with people too, and so there's a de-emphasis on hell and things happening there. So I think you're right. Each individual piece can kind of be considered on its own, but
in a way, I think, you know, we could. I mean, it's great that we've been able to get better reception, but maybe we haven't been doing it as much as we could, just because we've kind of been afraid to share some of our special doctrines that are unique to us. That I think people might like. But then, of course, Dan, I'm curious, any of you, if you want to bring up perhaps something that we've de-emphasized that you think might be detrimental to our image, that people would think, ooh, that's too much.
Oh, meaning glad that we are de-emphasizing it?
Yeah, or that if we were to emphasize, people wouldn't like it. I'm just trying to think of something.
Any of you guys?
Polygamy, race, gender stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Good.
Yeah.
Scott, any thoughts from you about Todd's question of, I don't know, how'd you phrase it, of could we have gotten to this status without this downplaying of the uniqueness? Any kind of angle in on that question?
I don't know. I think that's a great question. I have nothing to add. I'm sorry.
Okay. Can I weigh in
some
on the linear? Because I've been wrestling with the linear aspect of that question you were asking us. And if I could just kind of put on my religious studies hat and observe, you know, something religious studies scholars talk about a lot are revitalization movements. I mean, one of the ways religion evolves actually is through a process of renewal, through returning to, you know, elements of a tradition that may have been set aside, that may just sort of be residual, and sort of finding in those a source for a renewal of the tradition. So you look, for example, at, you know, American Indian religions who in the 20th century in times of struggle have gone back to older practices and revitalized them and revitalized
right.
the entire tradition. You know, you look at a tradition like Judaism, which I always go to, but it's one that I just know. It's not like I'm making it the pet tradition for Mormonism to source off of. But, you know, you'll find, I mean, there are strong differences between ultra-Orthodox, Orthodox, conservative, Reform, and the latest, which is Reconstruction. But you'll find, you know, even Reform scholars will go study for a while with Hasidic scholars who have kept alive older and far more mystical ways of apprehending the tradition. And they will derive value from those folks and bring it back into mainstream Reform life and deepen the practice of mainstream Reform Jews, you know, through that revitalization. Same with the Reconstructionist movement. And so, you know, that keeps me hopeful that it isn't a linear, like, you know, if we just, you know, boil the message down, we're going to keep going forward. It's like, no, this is a living tradition, and there are deep wellsprings of material that can revitalize us going forward. We're in a very interesting and maybe awkward transition, maybe from even seeing some of our own leaders move away from a literalist approach to questions like theosis and whether or not we get our own planets and whether or not heaven will be polygamous, you know, and becoming a bit more demure on those issues in public. You know, we're all adopting a more demure attitude on these strongly literalistic questions, you know, but that doesn't mean we can't go to some of these deeper, more cosmological parts of our tradition for renewing energy. And how that's going to happen is still yet to be seen.
Right, but you're at least sort of arguing that even if the moment looks like it's almost all but gone, it may not be gone forever because someone is going to dive deep down the...
You are keeping Mormonism weird. And I do my best to keep Mormonism weird.
Cool,
and, you know,
yeah.
You know, and I think there's strength in that, and there's energy and vitality in that.
Yeah. Do you think that the, what's the word, the bloggernacle, Mormon blog world, might have a helping role in that?
Absolutely.
I think it might.
Good.
Could I just share a short experience kind of about what Joanna was talking about? This is just on a personal level rather than on, you know, the whole religion itself. But I remember when I was a teenager, they had the Brigham Young book for the Priesthood and Relief Society. My parents had it, and I found it, and I was just kind of thumbing through it. And I was just so impressed with the stuff I was reading. I was just thinking, wow, how come I've never heard this kind of stuff before? And, you know, I found out later that even that was kind of diluted down a little
very,
bit.
Very tame Brigham.
Very.
Yeah. You know, from my perspective, you know, it was really exciting stuff. And then I remember, you know, when I got my first copy of The Teachings of Joseph Smith and reading King Follett and the Sermon in the Grove and these types of things, I was just really excited about it. And that gave me... This animation and kind of excitement about my own faith and my religion, and I didn't really get that just from Sunday school. I had to go out on my own to get that. But I think, you know, that could, you know, really enliven some people's faith, and so that maybe sometimes the block may not be as boring if we to just say it like it is. If we talked about some of these really interesting things,
there's a danger in that as well. You know, church has kind of become so boring on Sundays that a lot of us are going to external sources like the Blogger Knackle, the internet in general, and you know, that's where some of us are falling away. Where there's so much information available, and we get into that, and sometimes it leads us, you know, out of the church.
And I just, let me add, I get mail from different times I'm on the radio, different places. I get mail both from folks who are explicitly anti-Mormon and running anti-Mormon ministry saying, well, you clearly don't know much about your own religion, so here, look at this website.
Right.
And they, I mean, the material, and I've also got mail from, you know, parents of young adult kids who have found these sites. People, if we do not talk about the weird aspects of our own history, we are setting ourselves and our own people up to be shocked and disappointed.
Yeah,
and there are people out there who are actively scheming for our young ones, you know, they're predatory, and it's offensive to me because, you know, if we are ashamed of who we have been, other people will exploit that. There's just no room for shame in this game. You know, we have a complicated doctrine and history. It's given our tradition enormous power for a religion that's only 180 years old, and we need to learn to own that gracefully, even if we transition away from the most literalist rendings of it.
Woohoo! Yeah.
Amen.
Yeah, that's awesome. Let me add one little thought that at least this is how I was cutting President Hinckley some slack back in the days when he was distancing himself from, you know, the couplet and, you know, whether that doctrine is there and things. And that was the problem of our culture today, which is a soundbite culture. And, you know, we sort of gave an example of a little more elegant framing of the planets, you know, piece. All of these doctrines can be framed pretty elegantly, I think, within 2 to 3 minutes. But yet our culture and the media, and he was recognizing, at least this is the slack I cut him back then, he was recognizing that he's only going to get a 10-second soundbite to ever be reported, you know. And so is there any sense? So in other words, I was cutting some slack there, but now 20 years later or however many years later, I'm like, dang, I wish he would have, you know, taken Mike Wallace on a 2-minute tour, you know, to sort of frame some of the deeper sensibilities about Mormonism. So what do you guys think? Is it possible to ever get somebody's attention long enough to give them the elegant framing, or how would we go about doing that?
I think it might be. It would depend on the person. I don't, like, you know, I can't speak too highly of President Hinckley. I really, really admire him. I don't think that was, you know, just something that he was really interested in pursuing.
He wasn't a theological guy himself.
No.
Well,
he wasn't being strategic.
He said, like, I don't understand all the philosophical foundations behind it. A lot of us don't. But he did not deny explicitly that it was there. But perhaps, you know, if I don't know who it would be, if it would be a general authority or perhaps just somebody who is kind of a theologian could do that. I think could frame it in a way. I think I hadn't seen the Richard Bushman interview, but he seems like somebody who would be able to condense it down and give a brief synopsis of some of these, you know, interesting doctrines. But, you know, if a general authority or president of the church doesn't feel comfortable doing that or doesn't feel like that's, you know, really their thing, then, you know, probably shouldn't.
I have a question. Do they do that on Mormon.org very well? Do they kind of give background for weirder?
Mormon, yeah, it's interesting. Mormon.org, a lot of interesting, because I've had some experience with friends who have been putting profiles through and seeing what kind of get, because it's all user-generated on Mormon.org, right? You know, and what gets through sort of the editing transom. And yeah, some of the weirder doctrines do make it through, and I think actually average members who do live with these doctrines have nice narrative ways of presenting them, I think. So Mormon.org may be a strength, Scott. You're right.
Very good. Yeah,
I hadn't thought of that.
Yep. But, you know, one thing I'd observe is I'm thinking of, like, okay, Buddhism. I've read some Buddhism. The weirdness of Buddhism makes my head hurt. Because, you know, once you get beyond, especially Tibetan Buddhism, which was something my husband studied for a while, you know, once you get beyond kind of basic notions of this world is suffering and we're supposed to transcend desire and there's enlightenment and through compassion, there are, you know, very detailed meditations about the fourfold paths with the eight, you know, the eight jewels. And there's so many arcane details in Tibetan Buddhism. It made me feel like Mormonism was boring. You know, it was like, really? Huh. Jewels, paths, fountains, creatures. But you look at the way the Dalai Lama self presents, you know, and there are ways, as a very learned spiritual person, to, you know, to allow people who are not initiated in your tradition to glimpse its beauty without sweeping away its complexity, just letting them, well, that's sort of, you know, off limits, but here's the gist of it, you know. And I think we're absolutely capable of doing that as Mormons. And you know, if the Hinckley moment wasn't the right moment, you know, the Bushman moment may be a little better. And I just have confidence we'll come up with it in time. But, you know, it can't come from a place of shame, and it can't come from a place of marketing either, I think.
That's great. I actually think that's a good spot to be and to leave it. Is there anything in this question you guys want to keep going on before I just ask one final one? Is there anything at this moment you want to say?
Well, something that I was thinking about is I think part of the trend of simplification, that as we try and bring more and more people into the church and go global and cross different cultures, it seems like we want to get just the fundamentals across. So, you know, the plan of salvation, the restoration, those things that, you know, are very important. And I guess one of the tensions that we are dealing with, and I am optimistic that we will be able to figure it out, but is how do we present that to people in a way that it doesn't just overwhelm them, but then allow them the ability to start to get a little bit more of the depth of the doctrine? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Hint that it's there, even though it may not be there, but then make sure that the resources are sort of there for them to have a gentle glide into it, or I don't know if gentle is the right word, but is that what you meant?
Yeah. I mean, to use the scriptural term, we talk a lot about the milk before meat, right? And I just worry, you know, maybe we don't really get to the meat. But
right.
But I see the wisdom in that, right? And I guess I do understand why, you know, we need to simplify things to a certain level. You know, when you're teaching, you don't start off with the complexity. You start off with the basics. And I think that's part of the motivation behind all this. And so I guess I just want to make the point that, you know, there are good reasons for doing that, but how do we handle that?
I think it's great as long as we don't. I think we're just caught coming through a period where we've stigmatized people within the tradition who do like the more complex aspects of theology, you know.
And
when that stigma ends, you know, we'll kind of be able to say, and I think it will. I'm very hopeful it will. I mean, call me crazy, but why not be hopeful? You know, I mean, wouldn't it be great if someday there were a Mormonism where we could be like, well, there's those people. They're the Hasidic Mormons. They really like the weird stuff. And go talk to them. They're fascinating. I may not live like they live, but you know what? They really have some insights into the rich cosmology, you know, of this tradition, right? But the stigma's got to pass first.
All right. I want to take us into the home stretch, everybody. And for listeners, I just have to announce that we had some more real difficult stuff with Joanna's internet connection, and she's not going to be with us on the rest of the call. She wanted to express her love for everybody, and thanks for listening. And we're grateful for the chance that we had to interact with her so far, but she's definitely indicated she doesn't want to try to battle the technology anymore. So
I think she said to subscribe as well.
Oh, she, of course.
I'm sure she did.
That's my favorite thing about Joanna. No, just teasing. No, actually, subscriptions are coming up, and I appreciate that for everybody that's valuing what we're doing here. So thank you very much. All right, so here's my final question heading the home stretch here. Given everything that we've said, we kind of recognize that we're at this point in time where a lot of the more robust, cosmological, broader framing things are just not getting the airtime that they used to. So we're in this moment of a lot of simple things being taught at church, a lot of de-emphasis of differences between us and others. So I guess my big final question is, why would anybody really want to be a Mormon anymore? Is the emphasis on a vague plan of salvation now the plan of happiness? Is the emphasis on the family? Is it the fact that we have temples and what that signifies? Is that enough to keep people interested long term and to really create that kind of commitment in converts and in our youth who may, like you were sort of expressing, Todd, about you had never heard of these things and you were excited when you encountered them.
Oh, yeah.
So if the youth never encounter those, is that partly the reason why some of them are jumping out? Because there doesn't seem to be that much at stake to say be Mormon rather than be something else. So my question is, in today's church, at the level of the discourse, why be Mormon? Do you have any thoughts about that? Is there enough here?
Dan, I'll go first, mostly because I suspect Todd's answer will be more profound than mine.
Not even. Okay, but we'll let you go first, though, even though we don't agree with why.
I think there are great reasons to be Mormon, and I think they're still there, even though they're not taught in church. They still exist, and the Bloggernacle is kind of evidence of that. And we've seen with the Bloggernacle, we get a lot of people that aren't Mormon following the Bloggernacle, reading all the blogs, commenting, saying, "I'm not Mormon, but you know, I love to listen in on conversations. They'll even give their opinions and things like that." And so I think we're still attracting those people a little bit, and then for everyone else, we are so normal now, and so we apply to the normal side of everyone. We've got the slick "I'm a Mormon" campaign, you know, to show how cool and hip and normal we are, and you know, how in step and within mainline Christianity we are. So we are, in a sense, appealing to two different types of people with just different avenues. So I'm sure Todd can say more and give us a better answer there.
Well, those were some good starts and definitely some good observations.
And they better be good now, Todd.
Yeah, Todd. Now it's up to you, Todd.
Well, it's all because of the great setup you just gave me. So I'll try. Dan, I guess I want to kind of say in two ways. First, just the reasons with you know, our church as it stands now. Things we emphasize, things we don't emphasize. I think there are plenty of reasons to be a part of this church, a part of our religion. And then I guess I should just say that I think there could be even more, right? So let me start off with the things that the way they are presently. Just the community itself. I think, and everyone I talk to recognizes that there is such a strong, happy, loving community in the church, and that's not even really a doctrine, but it's just the practical side of knowing people, loving them, and having a place to build friendship. And then
And you're not saying other religions can't do it, but you think Mormonism does this really well. Okay.
Yes. Right. Absolutely. Okay. And of course, you know, so. I guess that's one thing that I really love about it. And of course, yes, many other religions have that as well. But even though I don't necessarily approach other people and say, you know, you need to be a Mormon. But if somebody wanted to join, I think they would have a lot to go off of and a great family to be a part of. I think we do emphasize the Book of Mormon very much, and I am a huge fan of the Book of Mormon. I think it is very powerful, and the doctrines and teachings in it are very powerful as well. And I
can't even believe that we didn't bring that up before. Isn't that interesting?
Oh, yeah.
That's crazy.
Of course.
But yes, we have this other scripture that is unique, and we haven't gotten rid of that idea. Yes.
Check it out. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Cool.
Exactly. And you know, and we have the Bible. The Bible's wonderful, but the Book of Mormon, you just think of all that. is in there that we can appreciate and share. I do think that we do youth very well. I had a great experience when I was a teenager in the church, just going on camping activities and kind of field trips. I'm not sure that's what we called them, but just going and seeing different things and spending time learning. And I think that we build very strong youth. So that, and it is a very good place to raise a family. And I actually, you know, it's kind of, we put so much emphasis on it that it's kind of like, yeah, we get the point already. But the emphasis on the family is very important. And I think it's one of the most important things in my life. But I guess this is kind of where I can take a little bit of a transition here. And I will quote President Packer here. I don't know if he would say
the first time ever on this podcast. Yeah. Okay, go for it.
Well, yes. President Packer, he had I'm paraphrasing this, but something to the effect of that the study of doctrine will change behavior faster than the study of behavior will change behavior. And although I don't know if that's true in all instances, but I do think that there's an important insight there that rather than just saying, you know, be good, don't do drugs, or the family's important, there are doctrines that are very powerful that can enhance our view of the family. And I think the expansive view of our eternal progression and destiny really gives this sense of a divine destiny for the family. And this isn't, I don't think it's completely de-emphasized, but there's even more we could talk about in that regard, that in our family, we're developing, I guess we could use the word intelligences, and kind of doing the same thing that God does with us, in that we have these companions that we want to set up a process where they can grow and develop and become our peers as well. There's just so much rich doctrine in our heritage there that can really give a powerful basis for the family. So, and that's something that we could make even better. And then just going even further, just the I think of Mormonism as having an unlimited view of life, of the world. Just very, I think of it as big thoughts, that we think big. And I think that's one of the coolest things. So this is kind of getting into the area of how we could make it even, you know, more appealing and more of a reason to be Mormon, is that there's this kind of world without limits in our cosmology, in our doctrine, that I think that when we figure out a way to, when we figure out a way to bring that to the forefront again in a way that will be palatable to people, and we can present it so they won't be distorted, that it's going to be even more appealing, and that the church will grow even more strong and robust.
Those were all terrific.
Great.
Scott, anything he said that you wanted to quickly echo or jump off of?
No, I thought those were great points. You know, one thing I appreciate about Mormonism, and I don't know enough about other faiths, so don't take this as knocking other faiths, but they're, aside from kind of the whole follow the prophet mentality that's kind of more black and white, there actually is a lot of room to have your opinion, to gain an education, to value science, and just kind of take an overall reasonable approach to your life philosophy within Mormonism. And you know, I, like I said, I can't speak for other faiths, whether that's there or not. Maybe some more extreme, you know, it doesn't have that. But that's one thing I've always appreciated about Mormonism, is that we're still encouraged to, you know, value things like education and things like that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Terrific. Let me just a couple thoughts that came up for me, Todd, during your stuff here is, and actually yours too, Scott, the fact that there's outsiders that are interested in finding Mormonism. And so they're obviously spotting a richness or at least a uniqueness that kind of has them at least fascinated. And then here's my experience. I'm with a group of guys. I've been part of a group for maybe 5 years. We get together once a month. There's a dozen or so of us, ages 35 to 60. And I'm one of the voices in there that is always talking about these big ideas in Mormonism and the richness and whatnot. And there's maybe four or five of us that are are active within the church and still, you know, finding compelling reasons to be in it. But then there's this whole group of guys, every single one of us had been on a mission, every one of us married in the temple, and there's these guys that are simply saying, Dan, what you're saying, yes, we recognize that from Mormonism's past, but it has absolutely nothing to do with today's Mormonism. And they just have lost hope in many ways that these things can be revitalized. You sort of see what I mean? And I have a feeling that there's quite a few listeners to this podcast, to Mormon stories and things like that, too, that are just sort of saying, I just can't, I don't have the patience to let the pendulum swing the other way, or for the richer ideas to come back, or, you know, or they've just somehow sort of given up on it. Do you sense, I don't even know what I'm asking here. I think we're just sharing experience. Okay.
We're so young that we're, you know, we don't know what's going to happen. There's ebbs and flows. And
okay,
you know.
So whatever's happening in the moment's really happening to all of us, but after a period of time, maybe what Joanna was talking about, that there will be the sort of Hasidic group. And whatnot. I've wondered about that, too.
Who knows?
Somewhere along the line, yeah.
I have hope.
Okay,
yeah, I guess I will just respond to that by saying that I am optimistic. I really am. And Joanna was saying the same thing. And I think part of that is just, I know that I'm, you know, young and new to this, but I'm just impressed with how much discussion there is out there. And the internet makes a lot of this available. And you know, sometimes internet discussions can be kind of facile and not have much depth to them. But I have seen a lot of rich exploration and conversation that is available. And I think there's a tremendous amount of scholarship out there as well that I've been very impressed with. There's new publications all the time that are investigating Mormonism through theology and philosophy and really taking a serious look at these things. And I don't think it's – I guess, you know, I don't want to totally go against the grain of the premise of the podcast, but I don't think it's as that it's dead. I think that it's still there, perhaps just, you know, not as emphasized, but I don't think that it's beyond the point of resuscitation.
That's my hope, and and I have optimism too, you know, so I agree with you. And I think that's what you talked about, that there is death out there, Todd, is a good way for us to end and to say, let's please have one of those good, non-facile, definitely deep, definitely rich conversations on the blog podcast, or the podcast's blog discussion here at MormonMatters.org. So I invite all the listeners to please jump in, join in. Let's have a terrific discussion. I think this has been a weird podcast for me, and maybe it's just all the stops and starts that we've had, and, you know, hopefully you listeners won't know about, you won't recognize too many of these as splices. They won't end up being ugly splices, but this has been the most interesting of the podcast for me in a long time, in the sense that I think we've sort of been all over the map, and I'm not sure that we drove towards particular points or brought it home in any kind of strange way. So I'm just hoping that that all of you who are listening will help us feel good about this idea was said, this idea was said, even if it didn't feel like maybe we were steering towards something quite as well as you as normal.
You know, Dan, it's a big topic, and we had investigated it, anything in a whole lot of depth, we would have not been able to complete
for sure.
It. But
for sure,
I think it works as a springboard.
Right, and I had a whole plan for us to not just deal with theology, but I really want to talk about church organization and all the stuff that you started to bring in there at the end about, you know, the way our wards are organized and the way we build our communities and our leadership structures and stuff. But we didn't get to that. So anyway, let's just end this. I have no clue about, with so many stops and starts, how long this podcast will end up being. I'm going to get editing it and try to get it up right away. And so, Scott Heffernan, thank you so much for being part of this. I hope you had a great time. And
I am honored. Thank you so much for having me.
We will try to invite you back and find those great spots where you feel like you really want to jump in. And Mr. Todd Decker, you've been amazing too. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been fun.
appreciate you guys reaching out and being fans of the podcast and now of contributing and all the different ways that you're doing. And it just means a lot. And on behalf of Joanna, well, first of all, thank you. Shout out to Joanna in case she decides to listen to this when all is said and done. But thank you, Joanna, for being so great. And we do encourage all of you to support the podcast if we can. It will keep going, I promise, without your support. But you'll feel so much better about yourself, right?
Of course.
When that $2 or $5 a month come out on your credit card or,
I know,
or
I
whatever
do.
You're making. You know what? I forgot. Thank you. You both are subscribers, so thanks so much on that. Anyway, I'm just going to say goodnight to everybody and again say thanks to you too.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks,
see ya.
Tom.
See ya.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.